supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In a rare move, Pennsylvania environmental regulators have indefinitely shut down all construction along a controversial natural gas pipeline connecting Delaware County and western Pennsylvania. The State Department of Environmental Protection says it had no alternative after Sunoco continued to violate permit conditions for the Mariner East 2 pipeline despite several violations and a court order. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports the move comes after dozens of construction-related spills resulting in homeowners losing their drinking water.
Drilling mud spills, polluted trout streams, sinkholes, and ruined water wells have plagued the 350-mile project. Sunoco had been operating under a court order since the summer after a Chester County community lost its water supply due to pipeline construction. Since then, other communities across the state suffered similar issues with their water. Attorney Rich Raiders represents landowners along the pipeline route. He says the company ran into problems with complex geology.
Sunoco severely underestimated their ability to understand how this old granite formation that Philadelphia and its suburbs sits on reacts when you poke holes in it.
Recently, the Department of Environmental Protection discovered that Sunoco had been drilling in seven separate locations without a permit. Kurt Naus is a spokesman for the Pennsylvania Energy Infrastructure Alliance, a pro-pipeline group that includes labor unions involved in the construction. Naus says DEP and Sunoco need to resolve their issues soon.
I think all of us want the same thing, which is safe development of this project.
Sunoco has 30 days to respond to DEP's new requirements before it can restart construction. The company issued a statement saying it expects to respond to the DEP's request and resume construction soon. The company recently told its shareholders the line would be up and running by the second quarter of 2018. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Camden, New Jersey, one of the state's most crime-ridden cities, saw a dramatic drop in murders last year. Details from WHYY's Aaron Mozell.
The Camden County Police Department reported 23 murders in 2017. That's a 30-year low and roughly half the murders recorded in 2016.
We haven't crossed any kind of finish line yet, but this is a positive aspect of 2017.
Camden County spokesman Dan Keeshan says the department certainly deserves some credit for the drop. Focusing on hot spots and arresting high-profile criminals are among the reasons why, but he says they don't tell the whole story.
When we see things like an increase in graduation rate, a decrease in dropout rates from the public schools, when we see expanded enrollment at Rutgers Camden through the Bridging the Gap program and ultimately $2 billion of private investment within the city, all those things contribute to the crime level.
Freeholder Director Louis Capelli Jr. helped usher in the Camden County Police Department, which replaced the city force in 2013 because of budget woes. He says the stats reflect a less dangerous Camden.
When I went to law school there in the late 80s, you know, parking in around the city later in the day or at night, you definitely did not feel safe. Always sought to park as close to the school as possible. Today, you can walk around that neighborhood as safely as you're in any neighborhood in Cherry Hill or Voorhees.
Longtime Camden activist Kelly Francis doesn't buy that. He says Camden is only safer on paper.
When you compare yourself against yourself, that's meaningless. All you have to do is just be one better than the previous year, and you can say, well, look, we've improved.
While murders were down in Camden, shootings were up slightly in 2017. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
There's good news at the start of the new year for police and firefighters in New Jersey, though it may have implications for homeowners already burdened by the highest property taxes in the nation. Joining me with details is NJ Spotlight reporter John Reitmeier. John, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome.
The good news comes out of Trenton, where lawmakers made a change by not taking action before the new year. Explain.
Yeah, that's right. So there was a law first enacted in 2011 and then renewed in 2014 put a cap, basically, on the salary increases that police officers and professional firefighters in New Jersey can get if they reach a contract impasse with their local government employers and they go through what's known as the binding arbitration process, that cap had been 2% going all the way back to 2011. The law was set to sunset at the end of 2017, and by not taking any action, Democratic legislative leaders let that cap, in fact, sunset. And so now the cap has been lifted, and that restraint is no longer on these arbitrators when they hear these contract cases involving the police officers and the firefighters.
Is there a way to assess how effective the cap was when it was in effect?
Well, that's been a matter of debate in New Jersey for the last several months, actually. A task force was set up to study the effectiveness of the arbitration cap, and several members were appointed by Governor Christie, a Republican, and several other members were appointed by Democratic legislative leaders, and those members never reached an agreement as to how effective the cap has been. The gubernatorial appointees released their own report saying that since the cap was first put in place, it saved property taxpayers an estimated $530 million in increases that they would have had to pay, assuming the old rules were in place. The legislative appointees never signed on to that report, and even though this task force was supposed to issue a final agreement and report on the effectiveness of the cap, they could never reach that agreement, and so this report never came out. So we only have the estimations released by the gubernatorial appointees, which seem to use pretty valid math.
Above and beyond the political wrangling, it has drawn the attention of a Wall Street credit rating agency.
Yeah, so Fitch Ratings issued a recent notice to investors to just let them know that this arbitration cap was due to expire and that in the future it could put pressure on New Jersey municipalities in the sense that there's also a broader 2% cap on property tax levy increases that's been in effect also since 2011 in New Jersey, signed into law around the same time as this arbitration cap. That's a permanent cap, and that remains in effect. So at the same time that the local governments are being forced to restrain their overall increases in property taxes to 2%, which most New Jersey residents are probably appreciative of, one of their biggest line items, that is the expenditures for police officer and firefighter salaries, are no longer subject to the same 2% restraint if they can't reach an agreement and they go through the arbitration process. So down the road, what this could force some towns to do, and this is the issue that Fitch raised, is make them consider either cutting services or proposing raising property taxes. And in New Jersey, the only way to get around the 2% property tax cap is to go to a referendum and ask voters if the local officials would have permission to go over the 2% cap.
By law, police in New Jersey are prohibited from going on strike. How does the arbitration process work?
It's set up specifically to prevent a situation where we have public safety union members on strike due to a contract dispute. And so the binding arbitration process is specifically in place to create a mechanism for the unions and the local officials to be able to mediate their difference and make a case before an arbitrator who will then say, okay, after I've looked at all the facts, here's what the new contract should be.
How do New Jersey police and firefighter wages compare to their cohort in other states?
Census figures indicate that New Jersey police officers and professional firefighters are among or are the highest paid in the entire country in their job titles. That was a point that was made in this report that was released recently by the gubernatorial appointees studying the effectiveness of the 2% arbitration cap.
With an imminent change at the helm, is there a sense of how Governor-elect Murphy will weigh in on this issue?
That's a really good question because Governor-elect Murphy's been holding his cards very close to the vest on this one. There was an expectation that possibly this task force could reconcile its differences and generate some final report that would make a last recommendation. Murphy had been saying he wanted to see a final report before making any final decision. He's apparently even said that again today, but there's little expectation that this task force will resolve its differences.
John, thanks for bringing us up to date on this issue.
You're welcome. Anytime.
And Jay Spotlight reporter John Reitmeier. The PEACE program in Philadelphia works with teens and young adults to treat early onset psychosis. And as Ann Hoffman reports from WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, the program focuses on the young person's entire family.
Ahmad Harrington is excited for his upcoming 17th birthday. He's confident, hopeful, and happy. But like most teenagers, he's pretty existential.
I'm always thinking, I'm ahead of myself. I'm always wondering about myself.
He thinks about girls a lot, and then he asks himself, why am I thinking about girls so much? In part, it's because he's analytical, but he's also started watching his thoughts more as part of his treatment for psychosis. Ahmad's program is called PEACE, which stands for Psychosis Education, Assessment, Care, and Empowerment. It's a program that works with teens and young adults who have early onset psychosis. He goes there for individual and group therapy. Psychosis is a set of experiences that relate to finding reality confusing or unclear. Not all people who experience it have schizophrenia. Ahmad doesn't, for example.
So it can be schizophrenia, it can be bipolar disorder, it can be trauma-induced, it can be substance-induced.
That's Irene Herford. She's a psychiatrist and the clinical director of the PEACE program. Ahmad has bipolar disorder, and psychosis can be a feature of that. These days, he has fewer visual hallucinations, but they still happen from time to time.
I see small things. Like I might see a bug fly by. It might not be there. Like I might try to grab it, and it won't be there. Or, you know, sometimes it actually is a bug, and it's like flying really fast.
Just 2 years ago, Ahmad was terrified of his racing thoughts. It was those thoughts that told him to hurt a teacher that convinced Ahmad's mom that he needed to go to the hospital. His dad worked in the field for a number of years, and his mom has had her own mental health struggles, so they knew the importance of not letting him try to get through this crisis on his own. And it turns out that's crucial when it comes to psychosis. Here's Ahmad's therapist, Ashley Park.
The earlier you're able to intervene, the sooner you can kind of put in place tools and supports that are going to help people be successful. The longer that people are ill, generally the more disruptive an experience they have.
And there's a lot of data that goes back several decades to support that idea, says Herford.
Symptom outcomes are better. Functional and quality of life outcomes are better. People have fewer relapses and fewer hospitalizations. So in many ways, catching it early confers benefits for the rest of the person's life.
A lot of the program is about psychoeducation, which means helping people understand their illness and helping their families support them as well. The program wants to target schools because they could be a great place for early detection. As it stands, kids are often misdiagnosed or simply missed at school. Perhaps because of that, Ahmad's dad, James Harrington, has always been a huge advocate for his son. Ever since teachers started reporting behavioral issues when Ahmad was little, playing an active role in his son's mental health care is almost like another job.
And you have to be prepared to deal with this stuff. And all society knows this, especially, I don't know if y'all know, but as a black man, all society knows this, to lock him up. You know, they don't know why he's reacting. They don't going to care why he's reacting that way. And nobody, you know, all they do is just push it out there as, oh, this person did that, lock him up. And that's the way it is.
Herford says parents often feel a sense of hopelessness when their kids get diagnosed.
The care is often sort of fractured and inconsistent. And meanwhile, their child continues to suffer. So I think for parents, it's a very frightening and isolating experience.
So what PEACE tries to do is bring in families from the beginning and offer thorough treatment. James Harrington says he's had to learn how to talk to his son so he doesn't trigger him. He's learned to be sensitive to Ahmad's needs and validating of his experience. That can be hard, and other family members have had different opinions.
So some people look at Ahmad and say, ain't nothing wrong with him. He's just tripping, you know.
James says he doesn't even react. He just listens and says, yeah, Ahmad will be all right. And that's part of why PEACE has groups for families going through the same experience, to break isolation and create support. As for Ahmad, he's learned from his sessions with his therapist what to do when he sees that telltale bug.
Sometimes I'll actually notify other people, like, Dad, have you seen that?
That's called reality testing, and it's something he's working on at the program. These days, Ahmad is feeling hopeful about the future, but he still gets pulled into his mind sometimes.
I could be writing, just finishing a test, and boom, I'm daydreaming again.
But the difference is?
I can snap out of it now, though.
Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
As portions of Philadelphia's real estate market heat up, the city is trying to tackle a difficult problem: how to get developers to build more affordable housing. Last year, city councils seemed to have settled on a tool being used in other cities. It's called inclusionary zoning, and after getting a lot of pushback from builders and neighborhood groups, city council broke for the holidays without a final vote on the bill. Joining us now to discuss what to anticipate in the new year is Jake Blumgart from WHYY's Planned Philly Project. Jake, let's start with a definition. What is inclusionary zoning, and what does that have to do with affordable housing?
So it's basically this way that a lot of cities have been trying recently to kind of get the market to create more affordable housing because the resources available from the feds or even from the state level are pretty restricted. And the need for affordable housing is so much greater than the resources that we are able to provide. Only about a quarter of the people who are eligible for affordable housing actually receive it. So this is kind of a way to kind of get the market to create it through the zoning code. And that means that the city is trying to get developers of a certain number of housing units to give a portion of those housing units to lower income people than they otherwise would.
So let's discuss our bill as championed by City Councilwoman Maria Quiñones Sanchez. She first introduced it in June.
Yes. So originally the bill would have affected pretty much everything in town. But she amended it to basically only affect zoning categories in the part of the city that sees like the tallest buildings.
So
like
we're talking Center City, University City.
Mm-hmm. Some of the main thoroughfares like Broad Street. If you're building a housing project of 10 or more units, 10% of those units basically have to go to affordable housing. Or you can pay into the city's housing trust fund, which then can be used by CDCs and other kind of affordable housing nonprofits to build housing of their own.
So, I imagine builders and developers are predictably up in arms.
Yes. They did not like the original bill. They don't like the current bill. In general, they don't like being mandated to do anything, really. As the zoning code currently works, they can choose to build affordable housing in exchange for an incentive, but being made to provide affordable housing is really, they hate that idea.
Of course, they love the idea of the 10-year tax abatement program that they've benefited from.
Right. And that is something that has kind of been stirred up in this controversy over the bill in council, which is a lot of housing experts who don't live here say that in a lot of other areas, people offer an abatement in exchange for the affordable units. But because we already give the abatement in exchange for just nothing at all, we don't have that option.
According to Zillow, since 2014, the median home value in Fishtown jumped more than 50% to around $250,000. And that amount makes it hard for even young professionals to make the numbers work. Will this inclusionary plan help those who are truly impoverished?
Mostly no. I mean, the actual units that they would be required to build on site would not be affordable to the poorest. Now, the advocate for the bill would say that if the developers choose to pay into the trust fund, which honestly they would be more likely to take that option. Now, that goes to organizations that could build housing for the poorest. Now, the other thing we should say is there's obviously a massive poverty problem here in Philly. And so the sheer number of people who require housing, only a tiny fraction of them will be helped by any kind of bill that the city is able to enact at the local level. There simply are not the resources here in town to provide the assistance that is needed in the city. That is something only really the feds can provide.
And paradoxically, we have a glut of abandoned buildings and houses.
Right. Yes, there is. That's something the real estate folks have really been talking up. They kind of are saying that we should be routing more money into fixing up older homes, which I think is something that paying into the trust fund that potentially could that money could be used for.
Is it your sense that some action will likely be taken by city council in this calendar year?
As we stand right now, it's pretty unclear what's going to happen when council comes back. They could vote the bill through as it exists now, but it seems very unlikely. Most of the observers I've spoken with don't expect that to happen.
Thanks for the insight, and we'll be checking back with you, I'm sure, on this issue. Jake Blumgart from WHYY's Plan Philly Project. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Not long ago, Savour magazine named the state it believes has the most rich and diverse food cultures in the United States, bestowing the title of Most Edible State on New Jersey. Tomorrow's show, we'll look at how the Garden State is going beyond accolades for restaurant dishes and also carving a niche for itself as the nation's center for the import and export of food. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.